Okay, good morning, everybody. Good to see you all. Welcome. We haven't run out of sheets if people need. I think they're in the middle. Good to see you all. Let us recap a little bit, and then we've got a few lines from the previous stuff. And I know a number of you won't have last week's stuff in front of you. It's just three lines, and I'll read it out and I'll make it clear as we go through. We have so far done four Mishnayot in this first perek, and we're going to do three just today. So over the past 4 weeks, we've done one roughly per week. We can do three today. And we're going to make a massive transition in terms of focus today as well, where we have been trying to contend over the course of the first four daf of this Masechet that justice is impossible. Real justice, capital J, everybody has got their just deserts, is essentially impossible. It's impossible to adjudicate the amount of damage you've done to someone in a way that you could be punished in exactly that same way. And there are times, even when we try, Edom Zomimim, scheming witnesses being the pristine case where we give you what you intended to give them. It's not arbitrary. It's not lashes. It's not taking off your hand. It's not execution. It's whatever you try to do to them, we get to you. And the Masechet begins with cases where it's impossible because you've accused somebody of being a faulty Cohen of a halal, and we've said, firstly, you may not be a Cohen. Even if you are a Cohen, we can't make you a halal in response because that would either damage your children's status as well, which isn't fair to them. And if we don't ruin their status, then it's not a replication of what you try to do to the accused. So it's just impossible. And we had Gallus also, it's impossible. You can't be sent into exile if you use somebody of deserving that. The same with three other cases. Eved Ivri accusing somebody of needing to pay atonement for the damage their ox had done, and a confession of being guilty. So in all those cases, we said it's impossible. That was the first Mishnah. We had the second Mishnah that said if you accuse somebody of divorcing their spouse, divorcing their wife in particular, and not paying the ketubah, and it turns out you're actually on vacation, very happily married, and they just made this up. You say, well, you try to cost me 200 zuz. So, but it's not entirely true because technically the odds are two-third likelihood she would end up with that money at the end of the day because either if you pass away first or if you eventually get divorced, they're going to get the money. So actually we've again got to try to adjudicate very carefully how much exactly do you owe and again, how do we determine that? What's the algorithm? Yeah, we go to the market and we ask people. We basically have to guesstimate how much people would pay. What's the market value for that? So it's again not very concrete in terms of, oh, you did this, you exactly deserve that. We kind of guesstimate, but it's closer, but we've got to figure that out. And then the third Mishnah was the case where you said they owe A owes B money by the end of the month. And it turns out, no, I do owe them money, but not for another 10 years. So did they try to lose you the $1,000 you borrowed? No, they try to lose you 9 years and 11 months with it. So you have to adjudicate how much is that worth. And that got us down a rabbit hole to do with Shemitah because we said, hold on, you've got a loan for 10 years. It's going to get canceled in the middle of Shemitah anyway. Do you have power over Shemitah? And it turns out that you might have power to weave around Shemitah if you both agree to circumvent that in the economic sphere, which led us to a discussion of barrels of wine falling into the ocean, whether you can dunk there for mikveh or whether we assume it might still be there somehow, even if you can't see it, as opposed to a river where it washes away. We spoke about a mikveh, and this is where we had all the graphic visual aids last week, where if you've got 3 lug of water and a drop of wine goes in and turns it purple, or if you've got just under 3 lug of water and a drop of wine goes in and turns it purple and it drops into a mikveh, how do you adjudicate if it's possible? And the bottom line, universal ruling seemed to emerge in all those cases, hamara, everything follows the way it looks. So it doesn't matter if there's 3 lug of water, which will chemically make the mikveh possible, if it looks like wine because you've put 3 drops in and it's diluted it, it doesn't pass on the mikveh. Even though chemically there's 3 lug of water which should pass on the mikveh, if it doesn't look like that, it doesn't do it, which we've said intimates again towards the power of consensus, of convention, of how we function as human beings. That led us into the fourth mission we touched on last week, which is still on this theme about how do we dispense justice. There was a debate between the sages and Reb Meir. If some pair come along as schemers, and we said, we say he owes $4,000, Rav Meir says, what's the punishment? You've got to pay the $4,000 and whoop, you get whipped. And the sages say, no, you just pay the fine. The way that justice is dispensed by the court is you only get one punishment for a crime. You can't have multiple punishments. That's the first part of the mission. And the second part was, what happens if I say, we saw this person threshing or plowing while muzzling their donkey, and they deserve to get whipped. So for Rav Meir, you're going to get whipped for having accused them of being whipped, and whipped for lying under oath. Two whips. 80 whips. And the sages say, no, just 40. You can only get one punishment for one crime, and we had a whole Amud last week dedicated to this discussion of why Rav Meir thinks you can get more than one punishment for the same act, even though we said, again, bottom line, we don't follow him, but we spent half an Amud trying to figure out how he thinks you can get punished in more than one way, and the symbolic case was Motzi Shemra. If somebody spreads false rumors about their spouse, the Torah explicitly says you have to pay a fine and you get lashes. So for Rav Meir, that's kind of the basis on which you can get more than one punishment for a single act. And the sages disagree with that for all sorts of reasons. And that led us again down another rabbit hole where we have a debate about getting punished for transgressions that are passive. The case being notar, you are prohibited from leaving over sacrificial meat that you could eat. And what do you have to do in order to transgress that prohibition? Nothing. Literally, you do nothing. You've got meat there, and I'm looking at it for 3 days, and I do nothing. That's my transgression. It's a lav she'en bo ma'aseh. There's no act. And bottom line, we say you don't get punished for that. But Ulla says you do get punished for that. And Rabbi Yehuda says you get punished for that. And they got all sorts of systems, again, based on Adam Zomerman. Adam Zomerman, you've got schemers standing there in court. What did they do? Nothing. They said words. They moved air around with their lips. And in halachic terminology, most of the time, speaking is not an act. I think the example last week, if often you see kids fighting with each other, and you say, what did you do to your sister? I didn't do anything. I just said. It's like, well, that's doing something. But again, the terminology of kids seems to make its way into court here, where speaking is not an act. And that was where we got to last week. The bottom three lines of last week's Amud says, hold on a minute. Rabbi Meir had a proof. Rabbi Meir said, you know how I know you get 80 lashes if you're Adam Zomerman? Because there's a verse that says, Kasher Zamam, you have to strike them for what they planned. And it also says, Aid Sheker, if you're a false aid, you get whipped. Those are two verses that speak about punishments. So the Gemara turns around and says, Rabbanan, Hailo Tana Rechaid Sheker, my drasha be. What do the rabbis do with that verse that says you can't be false witnesses? Parenthetically, that's an odd question the Gemara is asking, because all the time we've got verses that say prohibitions that you don't have to darshan. We say it's a lav shein b'maaseh. That's it. But they seem that it seems to be, this is one of the Ten Commandments. It says you have to hit them if they are false witnesses, and you have to hit them if they are Adam Zomim, scheming witnesses. So what is this false witness statement meant to do? So the Gemara says, the rabbis do use that verse, but they use it for what's called an azhara. Anyone familiar with the word azhara? So azhara has two different meanings in rabbinic literature, and they both are warning. One is, if someone's about to do a crime, and I don't think this is true in any case in American law, it might be wrong, but you have to prove intent in Jewish law if someone's going to be held accountable for a crime, whether that's a ritual crime or an interpersonal crime. And the way you prove intent is by making sure the moment before they committed the crime, you told them that what they're about to do was illegal, and they conceded it's illegal. Which makes it almost impossible to convict anybody in Jewish law in traditional terms. But if I see you're about to break Shabbos and I say, don't do that, that's breaking Shabbos, and if you do that, you'll be liable to execution. And they turn around and they say, I know this is breaking Shabbos and I'll be liable to execution. Boom, and then they do it. That's the perfect court case. If I just see someone breaking Shabbos, I can testify with a million witnesses, but if there was no azhara, no warning, there's no legs in court. So that's one kind of azhara. The other kind of azhara is Chazal presume there has to be a textual warning in scripture that there is a prohibition before the text can tell you there's a punishment. So it has to basically appear twice in Chumash. Every prohibition has to appear once with a punishment, and there has to be a forewarning where it says, Adam Zomimim is a problem, by the way, and Adam Zomimim get punished like this. So this Gemara says, it says the Ten Commandments, you shall not bear false witness. That's the Azhara. That's a warning that false testimony is a problem. You want to know what the punishment is, then it comes up again. Which causes a problem for Rabbi Meir, who said you need both for punishment. So I'm going to say, Rabbi Meir, where do you get the warning from? How do you know there's an Azhara in the Torah? Rabbi Meir, Azhara le'edim zomim nali, where did you get the warning? Rabbi Yiriyah Nafgaleh, he gets it from a different pasuk that says, v'hanisharim yishmo v'yuvelo sifu od, where it says, you shall listen, and you will not see any more if you add on, meaning if you testify badly. For Rabbanan humabaleh, so what do the rabbis do with that verse? And now we're on to Daf Hey. So everyone's got the sheet now, top of the page in the red. La hachraza. The sages say that pasuk is for hachraza. Now this is very rare. It's only in four crimes in Jewish life. The Bet Din has an obligation to announce after the penalty is carried out that so-and-so was accused and punished for the following crime. And one of them is Edom Zomimim, according to the sages. It's in Sanhedrin. There's another three cases that says at the top here, actually, in Rashi on the right. Arbat Trichim Hachraza. There are four cases where you need to announce after the penalty is carried out. I don't know if we'd call this public shaming. I think the only context this appears in American law is sexual abuse, where there is like a registry. But this, there's a registry, so to speak, or at least an announcement in the weekly papers after Edom Zomim have been convicted and punished, that they were punished for that. Reb Meir Hachraza, where does he get the Hachraza from? Yishma v'yuri nafka, full stop, that's where he gets it from. So at the end of that fourth Mishnah, we've determined you only get one punishment. The sages agree there has to be an announcement, so there's a publication of your penalty, full stop. We've now got one, we're going to do three Mishnahs, top of the page. We've got one more Mishnah on this theme. How do we dispense justice? And then we're going to very subtly pivot. By subtly, I mean, it doesn't say in the Gemara and I'm making it up, but hopefully it'll be helpful. Is we're going to pivot from capital J justice to capital T truth. Now that we figured out that dispensing justice is essentially convention and we have to do our best, we're going to get to, okay, and how, is there actually truth at the bottom of the day that we can access? How do we know who to trust in court? We've noted this before. Two people come to court and they say, we saw that person kill someone. Two people come to court and say, you can't have seen that because you were with us. Say, oh, well, obviously they're right. Why obviously they're right? It's him against him or them against them. How do we know who's telling the truth? So we're now going to begin down that road. How do we determine truth? We're going to talk about flying camels. Anyone ever done makot before or come across it? I'm not going to test you on all of it. But this is, because it's one of the shorter tractates, sometimes they it's one of the ones they do in high school. And this is sometimes a line that people remember from high school. You talk about flying camels. People think, oh, that's interesting. So we'll talk about flying camels. We'll talk about elfish eyesight. Anyone seen Lord of the Rings? That people have got the ability to see far further than anybody else. And we'll talk about an interesting case where it's quite possible you could plunge a dagger into someone's heart and not be culpable of any crime at all. And we'll talk about those possibilities, not advocating them, just talking about them. And then we'll talk about some astonishing cases where witnesses come to court and say, they broke Shabbos last Thursday. And then a pair of witnesses comes along and says, you can't have done that because you were with us. And then another pair of witnesses come along and say, oh, okay, they were with you, but we saw him break Shabbos last Thursday. And then the original pair who disqualified the first pair, I'm going to say, no, you were with us too. And then another pair comes along and says, we saw him break Shabbos on Thursday. And then these guys, you were with us too. And 100 guys come along, they say, you were with us, you were with us, you were with us. Technically speaking, those are the rules of Edom's own. And at some point, do we start saying something's off? Or these are the rules, and we go with it. So we're going to have to see that. And then we'll get to a case that we'll try to compare to that. What happens if there's a woman who's got witnesses for her case and then they get disqualified. So she brings another pair and then they get disqualified. She brings another pair. Say, at this point, is she just hiring people on the street? Or, you know, those are the rules. And if the witnesses work, they work. So we'll talk about that. And then there'll be a big fight with the Tzedokim. And we'll have the only piece of Agadata that we have come to so far in this Masechta in about four lines, which will almost be the icing on top of these two themes, that justice and truth is beyond our full grasp on earth. So let's begin. And there'll be some things along the way. Mishnah, second line down. Mishalshin b'mamon ve'en mishalshin b'maka. So we're still talking about justice. We haven't got to truth yet. So you divide up money, but you don't divide up makos. Now, this is the Mishnah that all the way on the beginning of the Masechta, we said, Rebbe says that each age has to pay their share. And we said, oh, that probably means you divide up money. And the Gemara said, no, it can't possibly be that. There's a Mishnah that says that. It must be something else. And that made us talk about an extenuating case when they go to confess in a court on their own and you divide up the witnesses. So this is that Mishnah. You divide up money, but you don't divide up makot. Kate said, what does that mean? If two witnesses say, you owe somebody 200 zuz, and it turns out they were scheming, they were just trying to cost that guy money. And again, it doesn't seem to their advantage. You know, it's not saying they owe us money. It just said they owe somebody else 200 zuz. So what happens in response? Mishalshin b'nehem. So you divide it up. So meaning me and my friend, John's still here. So me and John testifying, they owe 200 zuz. How much do we have to pay each? 100 each. Just out of interest, what incentive has just been laid down by this principle?
To get more
right. If you're going to scheme, pick a big group. At least when it comes to finances. Get 100 guys testify. All right, I'll pay 2 zuz if they find us scheming. But I think we're secured. So there's an incentive later. Well, obviously that's not the intention. But that seems to be the case. When it comes to finances, you divide it up.
How is that kasher zama?
Go on.
It sounds like each aide is responsible to go through the act that they would have wanted the other person
to do. Oh, so it sounds like you're channeling about 5 lines time. So I'll mention, this is Seth's question in 5 lines time. Great. So the Mishnah at this point says you split up money. Aval, im heidu shuchayv malkav. So they come along and say they were plowing and they muzzled their animal. They deserve to get whipped. So you think, oh great, there's 40 of us here saying we witnessed that. We'll take 1 whip each. At the 50-50 chance, they're going to get 40 lashes. I hate them so much. I'll take the risk of getting 1 lash. The Mishnah says, turns out, nim says, zo mim kol echad v'echad lo karabam. We don't split up lashes. You all get 40. Which is going to raise the issue that Seth raises in some sense, which is, why do you split money but you don't split lashes? Mana anamili, where does this come from? Amar Abaya. Abaya's got one reading, Rava's going to have another. Abaya says, Ne'ma rasha b'chayve malkiyash v'ne'ma rasha b'chayve mises. He says, there's no real logic for this. I can't fully explain why we don't split up lashes. It makes perfect sense. If 2 of us testify, they get 40 lashes, we should get 20 each. Just like you get money split up. But there is a gzera shava. There is a word in a pasuk where it relates to death. And guess what? If we come along and say they broke Shabbos and they did it on purpose and they should be executed, we can't turn around and say, oh no, just split the punishment. What does that mean? Half kill me? You can't half kill someone. Death is binary. So the fact that it says Russia with execution and it says Russia with Malkus, Abaya says, Malahalan ein mitel mechsa, afkan ein Malkus mechsa. You can't split it up. So essentially it's saying there are 2 forms of punishment. There's monetary punishment and there's, corporal punishment. And corporal punishment includes capital and lashes. It's all grouped together. You can't divide that up. Rava comes along and says, Ba'inan kasher zamam la'achiv. It's not because of a verse, it's just a logic. Amar ba'inan kasher zamam la'asot la'achiv. V'leke, you have to do what they intended. Now, we both intended him to get 40 lashes. You can't give me 20, because that's not what I intended. At which point Seth turns along and said, hold on a minute, i'achi mamonami. They also intended for him to lose 200 zuz, so why should they split that? And then you've got some very difficult lines. Not that difficult, but lots of readings of them. Mamon mitstaref, malkot lo mitstaref. Money mixes together, malkus doesn't. Say again?
Fungible.
Yeah, money's fungible, lashes aren't. But what does that mean? So there are different readings. Rashi's reading is, at the end of the day, you intended this person to lose, bless you, you wanted this person to lose 200 zuz. So I take 100 from each and I give it to him. It adds up. He's now got what we intended him to lose. Malkus, he doesn't collect anything. We just get hit. So there's no hit starve. There's no mixing together that he can say, I've now got what I desired. So there's no way to adjudicate the repayment. So we just split it up. That's the way Rashi seems to indicate it. Others suggest it a little differently, because the basis of that, by the way, is who gets paid? The victim, which is already an assumption, which we've noted already, there's a big contentious debate about. So the other reading is, and this makes quite a lot of sense, is that currency or finances is just cumulable. You just add it up. You've got 100, 200, and what is 200 divided by 2? 100. It's calculable. It's quite formulaic. What if I said, what's half of 40 malkas? Sounds like it should just be 20. But that's if it's an abstraction on a board. If I said, I'm about to whip you 40 times, at what point would you say you've reached half the experience of the pain you're going to experience by the end? Yeah, you might say 39. It could be that each progressive whip is as painful as everything else you've just had, which means 40 is as painful as the last. We can't adjudicate pain in that way. So in theory, we would just say, split up the money, put it together. So money is cumulable in that sense. But if we say split up and together, if we say you wanted to cost him 200 zuts, say 100 each, together you've now lost what you wanted him to lose. But if you say, I wanted him to have 40 lashes, and you give 20 each, together you have not got what we intended to give them, because the addition of the pain of 20 lashes is not the same as the pain of 40 lashes. So you both got to experience that full pain, because it just doesn't add up in the same way. That's another way it's read. We'd advocate avoiding lashes at all costs anyway. But that seems to be, again, how do we dispense justice? Bottom line is, at some level, it's impossible to split up between you. Finances is much easier. We've said you can dodge the whole rules of Shvius, of Shemitah, if you come to an agreement together. But in the corporal realm, it's very hard to adjudicate exactly what you wanted to cause them. How do you calculate bodily harm? You go to the market, you estimate. Here, we know we can't divide up the pain in any coherent way, so you just got to get the full set.
Isn't there a fundamental difference, like you said earlier? In other words, with monetary, you're compensating, let's say in this iteration, the victim. So as long as he gets 200, you don't really care how he gets there. While with Malkos, it's really imposed as a punishment on the Adam's own. So you can't, each person individually is responsible for the 39. So that makes sense.
Yeah, you're a big fan of Rashi.
You know how you said Mishal Shalim? So if me and you are Adam Zomerman and we each owe 100, but let's say I can't pay because I'm bankrupt, and you're not. So do you have to come up with the other 100?
So that's a discussion among the commentaries. It's a great question. Meaning, are we now liable for half the punishment each? Or as a group, are we liable? Right, so meaning, let's say we both come to court and we say, they deserve Malkus. And then we go to the doctor, and the doctor says, oh, well, you can't handle any lashes right now. I'm like, what? I'm going to get all of them? So it turns out that's also not great. But it turns out with lashes, they don't get divided anyway. But you're right, when it comes to money, is it just you two have to come up with the fund somehow? Or does the court say, no, you owe half each, and if you can't pay, so they're only going to get half the funds back? Yeah, so again, is it, because at the end of the day, he didn't lose any money. This is all a knas. It's all just a penalty. So again, right, which at least according to many, goes to the court unless the victim sues. The victim can sue and say, I want that money, and that's a separate court case, and the court would give it to them. Otherwise, what does the court do with the money? Right. It could lead to accusations of the courts just paying people to make people schemers because they need to make their living. So in some ways, the court has to be open to, if it gets sued, the money goes to them. Otherwise, it is their discretion. It goes to the court. You can imagine them say, schemers today, fabulous. And it's the, you know, the Madoff scheme. Oh, we're going to have a big lunch. So they have to recognize that money can go to the victim as kind of an outlet to avoid accusations. Okay, second mission of the day. And here, this is, for many, where the Mishnah should have began. If we're talking about Adam Zomamim, it's now going to say, what are Adam Zomamim? Which is why when the Mishnah starts, the Gemara begins, why are you starting here in the cases that aren't Adam Zomamim? It should really start here. And we've built up all this way, which we could say is the sages intentionally prepping us for the impossibility of justice and not getting us set on, oh, okay, let's make this work. But recognizing that this is all the background, that we do our best. Ein Adam Nasim Zomim Achi Azimu Et Atzman. They are not deemed schemers until they themselves are the target of the disproof. Meaning someone has to come along and say to them, you cannot know that this happened because I know a fact about you. Rather than I come along to court and say, oh, you said he killed him. It's impossible because he was killed on a different day by somebody else. I don't know where you were. And we'll get to that difference right now. Ketzad. What do you mean that you have to disqualify the Edom themselves? Amru, if they were to say, these schemers, Me'idim anu b'ish plonu shaharigat ha-nefesh, we know that he killed. Amru lahem, and if the two witnesses come along to disprove that claim in court, and again, this is, we're trying to get to the truth, capital T here. So we've now got an accusation in court. Me and John come along and say, somebody killed Reuven. And then two come along and say, Hechatem Edim Sharinar, how can you and John say that he killed Reuven? Harinarag o zeh o hahoreg zeh, either the murderer or the, what's the murderee? Thank you. Or the victim. Haya imanu ota hayomba makomploni. What do you mean he killed Reuven on Tuesday? Reuven was with us on Wednesday. You're right, he's dead now. Someone killed him Wednesday afternoon. But how could you say he killed him on Tuesday? Ein elu zomim. They're not schemers. Just out of interest. So what happened? You've now got two pairs of witnesses. One pair of witness comes along and says, he killed Reuven on Tuesday. Another comes and says, no, he died on Wednesday. He was with us on Tuesday. I don't know where you were. I can't point to you being kind of an innate liar because you weren't with me. So what happens now?
They take a shvor.
It's basically a stalemate. What do we know 100% for sure at this point?
He's dead.
That's true. What else do we know about these witnesses, 100%? Somebody is lying.
Or mistaken.
But somebody has said a falsehood under oath. And the context is, if you're mistaken, we consider that essentially lies under oath because it's built up. And this is from the Gemara in Sanhedrin, which we're never going to do on a Daf Shavuot because it's too long. There is a whole massive script that is read to every witness before they testify, including basically a drasha. Here when you get up on the oath, they just say, do you swear to hold to no much truth? But in Jewish law, if you're about to testify in a capital case, they begin with the story of Cain and Abel. And they talk about the power of words to kill. And if you kill somebody, and this is where anyone who's seen Schindler's List, what's engraved on the ring they give Oscar Schindler at the end, if you save a life, you've, what is it? Thank you. Anyone who saves one life, it's like you've saved the universe entire or something. That comes from that Mishnah, and that's a script, part of a script read to every witness in a capital case. Recognizing what you're about to say, you better be darn sure, because on your word, we will be willing to execute this person. You have to recognize if we kill them and you don't like them, it could be that their kids, would have cured cancer. You got to recognize you're going to ruin a whole line of potential human potential. And at that point, you might turn around and say, yeah, maybe I'm not so sure, and I'd back off. And you basically scare people out of the prospect unless you're 100% sure. So at that point, even if you're mistaken, you're liable for lying under oath, because we've given you the context that what you're about to do has high stakes. And at this point, we've got two witnesses, and both of them are claiming opposite things. Either they said, we know he killed Reuven. And they say, no, he was with us the whole day. So they're not schemers, but there's conflicting testimony. We know somebody is wrong, and maybe lying is too hard a word, but somebody is saying a falsehood and cannot be relied on for future testimony. Does it mean that all four of them can never be trusted in court again? Because we know, Suffolk, one of them's lying.
CSI.
Say again?
CSI.
CSI, they could make a nice episode out of it, that's true. So it turns out that they've got a chesgat kashrut, meaning they've not been proven to be liars under oath. We know that somebody's not telling the truth, but we don't know who, so you just keep going, with one exception. There's only one way in which they can ever testify in court, and that is if one from each pair get together to testify about something else. Because at that point, we know that one of you has participated in false testimony. We don't know who, but we kind of bear in mind that since there's been conflicting testimony, one from each pair can't testify together, even though separately we let you carry on because it's not been disproven. So again, we let people testify, even though there's a 50-50 chance they've lied under oath. What do we do about truth? We do our best, and we can't, cast aspersions on people if we don't have evidence. So that is not schemas.
Don't you look for evidence? Don't you find anybody else who saw this guy alive on Wednesday?
Right, so we live in a world where, and this is partially why this is powerful, I think, or resonant, is that we live in a world where we feel like we're always going to find the evidence for something. It's got to be out there. There's going to be a trace of something. If there's an investigation and the FBI's doing their job, they're going to get to the bottom of it. That tends to be how we feel. There's, you know, fingerprint evidence. We've got forensic scientists. You've got cameras everywhere, CCTVs. You can barely move. The FBI is probably tracking. They're probably listening to this right now, falling asleep on terrorism cases. That's how we feel. And the thrust of what we're pushing at here is sometimes we can't. And even though we live in a world where we feel like we're going to get to the truth, we're going to get to just give it time. And you hear this all the time when investigations are being carried out. And families feel this way often when they've got a forensic team working on a case. They'll get to the truth. And here the Gemara is intimating and the Mishnah is indicating that's not always the case. In this world, often things go without proof. People who you are convinced did something terrible need to be held accountable. Sometimes accountability is beyond us if we don't have enough evidence. And prosecutors have this all the time. I don't have any close friends who are prosecutors, but I've seen prosecutors interviewed. They'll say, you know, we had this person, we're 100% convinced they did a crime. We couldn't get the evidence to a place where we felt we could convince a jury, and we just dropped the case. And they live haunted by a sense that we know they murdered someone, or we know they stole something, but we didn't have the evidence, so we just got to let it go. And that's how. And does that mean they're innocent? No. Just means I couldn't convict them in a court of law on earth. And that's kind of the push here is don't think that we're going to find resolutions to everything on earth. And that's where the Agadata will lead us. So we're now, first word on the line is B'makom, halfway through the Mishnah. This is the case of Zomamim we've been waiting for. Aval, Amru Lahem, if you say to those witnesses who said he killed Reuven on Tuesday, Heich atem me'idim shari'etem ha'yitem ha'yom oto ha'yom b'makom ploni, how can you say that you were with us? We're not saying that the victim or the murderer was with us. You two, John and Dov, you were with us the whole day last Tuesday out on a walk. How can you possibly say you saw a murder take place? That's Adam. Zomimim, Veneregan, Alpihen. Not going for a walk with them again. We can be killed on the basis of that testimony, which again, by strict measures of truth, is not that logical. It's just us versus them. Fine, so don't kill the guy on our basis, but don't put us to death. Who do you know? How do you know who's right? Boachirim, and now the Mishnah carries on. What if others come along and say, no, he did kill Reuven on Tuesday? The hazy moment, then that original pair said, no, you were with us. This was a group walk, and you were on that walk with us. Boachirim, hazy moment. Then another pair come along and say, you killed Reuven on Tuesday. And they say, no, you were, it was a shul-wide walk. We all went. What are you talking about? A filu mea, even if there are 100 and it says we were going on a 110-person walk, you were all with us. I don't have a faintest idea why you're all coming along to say he called Reuven, but you're all schemers. Kulam yeragu, you all get killed. So on the basis, and this is where we kind of stretch the power of how much this is not about us, capital T truth, you've now got the, when it's two against two, I don't know which way to go, but you've now got 102 against two. You've got this one pair who keeps saying, you were with us, you were with us, you were with us. And you've got the weight of 100 people saying, he killed them on Tuesday. And yet we're going with the pair. Because if you're following the rules and you disqualify them, that's the power of the accusation of scheming. It's possible. It's not about numbers. It's just a kind of contention of the biblical text. That's how justice works. That's how the rabbis put it. Rabbi Yehuda disagrees. Rabbi Yehuda says, no, this is not just how we do justice and how we find truth. We have to try and get as close as possible. Omer, he says, istatit hi. This is a scheme. This is a plan. You've got these two witnesses just accusing everybody being schemers. Guess what? They're friends with the accused. And they think, oh, he'll pay me $1 million. I'm going to save him getting executed. And everyone who comes along, I'll just say, they were with us. They were with us. They were with us. It was a huge party. They were with us. Enu Nerag, and this is a difficult part of the Mishnah, which is going to leave the Gemara saying, yeah, I'm not sure. He says, no, it's a plan. You only kill the first pair. Meaning, so you've got two witnesses who says, John and Dov, you were on a walk with us. You couldn't possibly have seen that murder. Now we're scheming witnesses. And then you've got another 100 come and they say they're all schemers. And he says, that doesn't count. Because that's just, you can't all have been together. But me and John are still executed for being schemers. And now the Gemara is going to say, well, hold on a minute. If you trust them, you trust them, and everybody should get killed. And if you don't trust them, they're scheming, why should we get killed? And the Gemara basically ends by saying, yeah, not sure. Kasha.
Why do you need 100? Like, if you have two, and you're saying, like, why 100? Like,
if
you need three, have two, why do you need the other 98 or whatever?
So this is not a group testimony of 100 people. This is 100 groups testifying over time. But you're right, what we'll come to in the Mishnah on the next daf is, you know, what happens if you've got 100 witnesses in one group versus two? Does that have more weight? But at the moment we're talking about 100 separate groups coming, which in theory would have more weight, but they still get pushed back. Okay, we're going to get to the flying camels in the next part. So the Gemara now, we're going to get to the bottom of the daf. Manahanimili, where do you know this from? How do we know that when it comes to Edom Zomamim, the only way to make them schemers is if you say you were with us, as opposed to the other form, which is to say you can't have known that the victim was with us. I don't know if I said what that word is. That's called hachasha, which is contradiction. Hachasha as opposed to hazama. Hazama is you've been found to scheme. Hachasha is you're just contradictory and we're at a stalemate and we've got to throw the case out, so to speak. So how do you know for them to be Edom Zomamim? Which again, if it's, and this is radically different. If witnesses come along and say, you couldn't possibly have seen the murderer was with us that day, what happens to us as witnesses? Nothing, the case is thrown out. If they say something which essentially is the same result, it didn't happen, but we know that because you were with us, what happens? We're put to death. That's a massive gap. So saying, well, how do you know suddenly that schemers, as long as you are disproven by claims that you weren't there because you were with us, you get killed. How do we know that? Ravada, we've got two possible verses. Ravada begins by saying, it says in the Pasuk, Vehine, Eid Sheker, Ha Eid Sheker, Ana. It says, Eid Sheker, and it repeats, Eid Sheker. In the case of Zomim, it has to be that the witness is false. Not just that the Eidut, the testimony doesn't stand up, but the witnesses themselves are liars. Until it is the actual testimony, the testifiers themselves, they're not considered schemers. The Rabbi Yishmael Tana, it was taught in the house of Rabbi Yishmael, La'anot bo sara, that you got to testify to answer that they have veered away. Bo meaning it or him or they. Until the testifiers, the witnesses themselves, are disproven, full stop. Those are the two biblical sources where schemers work this way. Now, Rava is going to have three different cases where we are really going to put to the test, is this about the truth or is this just the rules of court law? Rava says, Boshnaim va'amru. And this is where, I don't know how many of you got this table. Did everybody get a copy of this table? It may not be necessary for many of you. I thought it would be helpful to clarify, again, a visual aid in the third case that he brings. First case he brings. Baushnaim va'amru, two come along and say, B'mizrach bira, on the east part of the citadel, meaning if you want to think about a big building, you've been to the New York Public Library main building with those big lions on the front? Yeah, so imagine you're standing on the roof of that building. Well, actually, it might be easy if we say it was the, I was going to say the Empire State. Let's use that. So you're standing on that, and you say on the east of wing, we saw a murder take place on the east wing of the steps of the New York Public Library. And two come along and say, but you were with us on the west wing of the building. How could you possibly have seen that? And meaning, you were with us. This is the case of schemers. You are going to be put to death now on the basis. And again, you should watch out who you hang out with. Because they come along saying, everyone's saying, you were with us. And we're willing to let you die because you were with us. Which again, even though I've said that in jest, people who you are with are very unlikely to want to go to court and say, on the basis of my word, they should be put to death. Which is telling you how high stakes this is, how unlikely it is for people to want to do this, and how committed people have to be to a system of justice. So what do we do? Chazinan, ika dekaimu b'marav bira, michzi chazu l'mazrach bira. We have to assess. Meaning, the New York Public Library, you're in the east, you say, I saw a murder on the east side. A couple come along and say, how could you possibly have seen that? You were with us on the west side. So what do we have to do? We have to send out court researchers to go and see if you can do what? If you can see from the west to the east. And if it's possible to see, so it doesn't matter. So you were with them. So what? You were talking. Guess what? They were zoning out because you know how to talk and they were getting bored and they were watching a murder take place across the way while you were talking. But if you can't see from the west to the east, so you've now been placed away from the scene of the murder in a way you can't see it, they are schemers. And the Gemara chips in and says, Pshita, you know, thank you, Rava, for that very important innovation. This is just a regular case of Zomim. Meaning, you've just said, if they could see it from where they were, then it's not Zomim. If they couldn't, they weren't. Thank you, Rava. So the Gemara says, no, this is what he's teaching. You might have thought, Lechesh le Nahura Beria. Maybe you say, if we send court researchers and they come back and they say, oh, you can't see the east from the west at all. What if they got great eyesight? Maybe we should be worried that these, we're about to put them to death. This isn't just an abstraction. We're about to kill two people. Maybe they've got amazing eyesight and they can see from the east to the west. Kamash Malan, the Gemara says, no, if the court researchers say you can't see, you're getting put to death. Which gets all the commentators saying, well, what happens if they say, no, 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 we've got great eyesight, test us. And you test them, and it turns out they've got unbelievable eyesight. Sounds like Rava says, we don't care. These are the rules of the game. Which again, how is that justice? How is that truth? If we've got two witnesses who come along and say, we saw this happen, test our eyesight, and they can say, well, it is unbelievable how far you can see. And they come along and say, we saw a murder. But two people say, you were with us in a place that we couldn't see it, and we're going to put you to death. Sounds like if we're really going for truth, who should we believe?
Them.
You should. They say they can see it. They've proven that they can see that far, and yet Rava is saying this is not about capital T truth. This is about adjudicating justice. And if we know you've got great eyesight, guess what's going to happen now? You're going to walk all over the city saying I saw things, and no one's going to be able to disprove you because you can see in an abnormal way. And we know you can because you've proven to us you've got that capacity. But you've now been empowered to access a truth that we can't cross-examine. Because you've got the gift of sight that we can't challenge. So Rava's saying, you know what? And this is astonishing. You've now got a case where two witnesses say, we've seen something. And it seems to be Rava saying, I wouldn't bring it up. Because you're the only ones who could have seen it. And if you're the only ones who could have seen it, you're trying to adjudicate a case that we can't cross-examine. Because nobody else can see as good as you. So it's much better that you don't mention it. Because if someone comes along and says, you were with us. I know we were with you. We were at the top of the Empire State Building. We saw a murder take place down on 36th Street. So you can't possibly have seen that. So trust me. And then we take them up to the top and they show you. They say, we see somebody's wearing a red jacket. I'm going to read off the number plate to you. We say, okay, I believe you can see that far, but I can't believe your word for a murder because nobody else can cross-examine that. So where is he going to put you to death for bringing that up in court? It's astonishing. But that seems to be the implication. Others disagree and say, no, of course, if they could prove they could see far, we would not put them to death on that basis, but that seems to be the implication here. Amar Rava, Rava's got a second case. Boshnaim va'amru. Here are the flying camels. If two people come along, va'amru basura basafra b'chad b'shabta harik ploni tanefesh. In surah, on Sunday morning, we saw somebody kill somebody else. Uvoshnaim va'amru b'panya b'chad b'shabta emanu ha'idim in aradeh. And this is a whole note. So you say, we saw a murder take place in Jamaica States on Sunday morning. And two people come along and say, but you were at a L'chaim in Teaneck on Sunday afternoon. And we all know it takes hours to get to New Jersey on a Sunday afternoon. You couldn't possibly have been there. You were with us in a way that disqualifies you from being there. So this is testing when we say you were with us on that day. Do you have to say you were with us at that moment? Or we just have to place you so that it was impossible for you to have been at the scene of the murder. Chazinan, im itzar for Lepanya, matzi azu masur l'naudea. So we have to assess, send out researchers, somebody go on Sunday morning, take a drive from Jamaica States to Teaneck, see how long it takes, see if you could be one place in the morning, one in the afternoon. If you could, not schemers. And if you it's impossible to get there by the afternoon, there's Zomim. Gemara again says, Pshita, like, why do you feel the need to stand up and say this, Rava? Obviously, that's what it means. If they could have been there, it's not Zomim. If they couldn't, they couldn't. Mo detem, you might have thought, Leichesh lagam la parcha. You might have thought, yeah.
Are we assuming that second set of witnesses who contradict the first, that somehow we're proving what they're saying is true? I mean, you can't just accept one and not accept the other, right?
No, it seems to be. We are. How do we prove things? The only way we prove things in Jewish court.
If they were with them, there might be witnesses, there might be other people there.
That would certainly bolster the case, but it seems to be in Jewish law, the only evidence that's ever acceptable is the testimony of witnesses. Sometimes documentary evidence works, but only if it's signed by witnesses.
So you've got two witnesses saying one thing and two witnesses saying something else. How do you?
That's why this is in some way so innovative. Meaning, in the case where they just say something else, it gets thrown out because it's two against two. But if they accuse you of scheming, seems to be an exception where we trust the latter case. Now, there is some logic suggested as to why that will be. We'll get to at some point. One possibility is, because you can't be believed about yourself. So you don't count as witnesses about yourself. So if somebody accuses you were with us, they've actually got a leg up, because you can say, no, we weren't with you, we were there, you can't testify about yourself. So actually it's 2-0 in that case. That's one logical explanation, but it's not a brilliant explanation. Because then anyone can say anything about anybody and say, well, you can't be believed to disagree. And it seems it's just an innovation, which is exactly why this is not about truth. This is about the biblical text saying we have to adjudicate cases. And it means, what's the incentive here? Is if I'm going to testify about a murder, I'm going to be darn sure that no one can come along and say I was with them. Although anybody could in theory do that. And I'm going to have to hope that if anybody does that, somebody else is going to come along and say, you couldn't possibly have said that they were with you because you were with us, and you're going to panic. But you're right, it's injected some anxiety into the court system so that when you're testifying about punishment, everybody's on edge, which is essentially terrifying. But that's what you want. You want people in court to recognize this isn't a game. It's not just, oh, you owe money. It's not like a place to come and solve your issues. This is a place to adjudicate truth as best as we can. And you should know if you put yourself out there on the stand, you might end up being killed. Or you might end up having to do what you've just accused someone else of doing, because anyone can come along and say you were with us. And if that stands up and no one contradicts them, you're going to get fined. So there's always this weight of a testimony. Like, what's the incentive to tell the truth in American law under oath?
What? Don't tell perjury charge.
Yeah, what happens if you don't tell the truth under oath in American law?
It's criminal offense. Perjury.
Perjury. What happens if you are convicted of perjury? I don't know. Is it always jail? Is it sometimes?
Well, in New York, you probably just let go forever.
Right. So there we go. Thank you. So if that's the case, what incentive is there for me to not lie in court? Meaning, if somebody's annoying me, I'm going to go to court and I'll testify. So they'll catch me on perjury. So they'll put me out. I'll pay my $100 bail. I'll go out and I took a risk. And what's being injected into the system here is, if you get caught lying, you might have to do exactly what you just tried to do to them. The court system is not a way to exploit kind of physical power against your enemies. And sometimes it ends up that you're going to get hurt and it's not your fault. But the whole system is now tapped up in such a way that going to court is like a last resort, is how it seems.
So what's your incentive to tell the truth? Who wants to go to the court at that point?
The only
anybody can just get away with murder because nobody wants to get involved, because they can end up.
And this is where I'm sure many of you are familiar with the famous statement of Rabbi Akiva, that a court that killed once in 70 years was called a bloody court, where he gets to the point where no one would ever be executed if I was in charge. And this is where it goes to. But then the pushback is, well, what happens to justice then? What, society will fall apart. So the only incentive to tell the truth is basically that you feel like you have to tell the truth. And in Sanhedrin, there will be Gemaras that it's actually prohibited if you see something not to say something. I don't know if that's true in American law. If you've witnessed a murder, are you held in criminal contempt if you don't testify? I think you're always empowered not to testify, right? Fifth Amendment means that I don't have to speak if I don't want to. But you can always say, I don't want to speak if I don't want. Or can they compel testimony?
If you're subpoenaed or you're deposed.
You're right. You're compelled testimony. Otherwise, you can be held in contempt of court. Right, so that applies in Jewish law as well. So some incentive is, so this is like, you're stuck. If I see something and people know I see something, I've got an obligation to testify or I can be held in contempt. But I know if I go on the stand, I'm now vulnerable. So you're right, it's a messy system where, could everybody just follow the rules and we don't have to do this? But that's how the stakes have to be played, it seems. Where everybody's trying to balance. We want justice to be ensured. We want society to be balanced. We want to avoid crime. But it's very hard to make sure the incentives are in the right place so that no one can abuse the system. So it's complicated. Yeah. So you've got this case. Can you get there in the afternoon or not? Pshita, Ma'u Detema, the first word in the line is Lenahar Dea. It's about 20 lines up. So you might have thought, Leichesh Lagamla Paracha, that court researchers can come along and say, we've just tried that drive from Jamaica States to Teaneck on a Sunday morning. Boy, it is impossible. If they were in Teaneck at 3, they left on Motzei Shabbos, I'm telling you. It's not possible they started the drive Sunday morning. And then what if the witness says, no, we have one of those new fancy flying things. I mean, helicopters, that's one option. But I know Uber's been working for like 10 years on some flying Uber that you could just like, it will park in your driveway and then fly you off somewhere. So are we worried that they had access to this or not? And again, my instinct would be, well, ask them. How did you get there? And if they say, oh, we got there on a flying camel,
Which again, what does it mean, a flying camel? Is it being like facetious, or does it just mean a fast camel? Possibly one or the other. I remember when we did this in high school, this is where the rabbi said, they obviously anticipated helicopters and aeroplanes. Chazal, and they didn't want to say helicopter because that would have given away that they knew everything that was coming. So they said a flying camel. But this is what they meant. Which again, when you're in high school, you're like, wow, I mean, Chazal, they knew everything that was coming. At which point you say, well, you don't have to spoil it, but just invent the helicopter then, you know, just get on with it. Save people the trouble. But do you worry about this or not? And the Gemara said, Rava says, Kamash Balan, no. If this is basically impossible, a flying camel is impossible. The idea they may have had eyesight that you can see 4 miles, it's basically impossible, but they could prove it to me. And now they could come along and say, look, here is my flying camel. Look at it. Boom, and off it flies. And they go, wow, you do have a flying camel. In theory, you could have made it. I'm really sorry to tell you this. It don't matter. We don't worry for that. We don't compute that into our case because nobody else has access to that. And you've now been gifted a supernatural capacity to testify on all sorts of things that we can't cross-examine. So you're out. Amar Rava, third case. Boshnein Varma, and this is where you might need the chart. And this is the most, so we've been building up to what the court says is truth by law, but that's not the same as truth in fact. And this is going to be kind of the proof in the pudding. Boshnaim, two come along for Amru and say, B'chad b'shabata charad ploni et nefesh. Sunday morning, they killed. So here you've got on the chart that I handed you out. Adim testify on Tuesday. That's going to be the blanket case. These witnesses, me and John, come along on Tuesday and we say, Reuven killed Shimon on Sunday. So this is the first line, first row. Adam Zomim claimed they accused the kill victim. That was on Sunday. But people are going to come along and say, no, that's not true. Voshnaim, two come along, Va'amr, and they said, Imanu ayitim b'chad b'shabata. You were with us on Sunday, so your schemers, you couldn't possibly have seen that. Ella betray b'shabata harag ploni t'nefesh. But on Monday, Shimon did kill Reuven. So what you're saying in court happens to be factually true. Reuven did kill Shimon, but he didn't kill him on the day you said because you were with us. So now what's happened? Have you lied under oath? You have kind of lied under oath because you said you saw it on Sunday, and that's not true.
They're swearing to two things, you're saying?
Say again?
They're swearing to two things.
Who's swearing to two things?
The Adam.
Which Adam?
You're saying that they were with him on Sunday, and they killed him on Monday.
Correct. So they come along, correct. They come along and say, you couldn't possibly have seen it because you were with us on Sunday, but we did personally happen to see the murder the next day. Correct. Or they're testifying to two things. Right. So they testified to two things. At this point, the first witnesses who have now proven to be schemers because they weren't there, they've testified to something they didn't see, happens to be that what they said was true. The guy did kill that guy. He deserves to be punished. So if we're thinking about Zomim is you should get what you intended to do to him, he deserved it. He's a murderer. And yet, you're still going to be held accountable. V'lo od, but we're going to say, and not only is that case true, where it happens to be that the day after the murder took place, afilu amru ever shabbat harag ploni t'nefesh. If they say it didn't happen on Sunday because you were with us, and this is the second row, but they say, oh no, the murder took place on Friday. You didn't know this. You were planning this for weeks. You say, next Tuesday, November 8th, we're going to go to court, and we're going to say A killed B. And we testify on Tuesday, A killed B on Sunday. Two witnesses come and say, you couldn't possibly have known that you were with us on Sunday, but while you were scheming this, the murder actually did take place on Friday. The same people. So it turns out not only did it happen to end up that what you said turned out, but it took place before you testified. So as you were saying, A killed B, that was a truth. You weren't there, but it was true. So when you say you get what you wanted to do to them, they were a killer at this point. So what happens? Neragin. You kill the schemers. Debahaidna dekama sade, because when they were testifying on Tuesday, Gavra love Barkitalahu. He wasn't dead yet. So, meaning, you still try to get a man killed. You try to get Reuven killed, even though he was a murderer. Even though he murdered somebody on Friday, the person you accused him of, he was walking around breathing at the time. And you wanted to get him killed, so you should be executed. My Kamashman, the Gemara says, okay, again, Rava, thank you very much. I'm not sure what innovation you're bringing here. We know this to be true, and it's going to set a Mishnah coming up that makes the same case. Stop. Says there's a Mishnah that basically makes the same case. And this, again, it can involve a little bit of a description. You've got a murder taking place on the shtender. Imagine the shtender is not to scale. This is a field. Got a murder taking place in the shtender. I'm here with a pair of witnesses, and I say, I saw the murder took place. And then two witnesses come along over here and say, we saw the murder take place. You're going to have two people testifying to the murder, and then these two over here are accused of being schemers. So you weren't there. Turns out they're schemers, but the murder did take place. So we've got witnesses testifying to that. So who gets killed in this whole complex situation? You've got, am I going to get killed for lying about something that took place?
Yes.
So I get killed, and the murderer gets killed. And the Mishnah says that happened. So they're saying to Rava, we know that even if what you were saying was true, if you were scheming, you get killed. What are you innovating? And he says, oh, you want to know innovation? Buckle up. Because here it comes. Kamash Malan, what's he teaching? Next line. Seifa. First word in the line is Nimseit. Seifa, Masha Ein Kein Bigmar Din, it's Trichale. It's what I'm about to say is what you need it for, which is given in code, that not when there's a Gmar Din, but let's explain it. This is the case. Ba'u Shnaim Va'amru. Two come along and say, Bechad B'Shabata, Nigmar Dino Shel Ploni. On Sunday, this person was had a verdict passed down that they are to be executed. They were found guilty of murder. Not they killed, but they were found guilty of murder in court. Ba'u Shnaim Va'amru, and two come along and say, Bechad B'Shabata, Imanu Ayitem, you were with us on Sunday, Ela Be'erev Shabbat Nigmar Dino Shel Ploni. But on Friday, he was found guilty. V'lo Od, and this is, that was the third line, third row. And now the fourth row, even if you testified on Tuesday, me and John testify, and you have to forgive me this, me and John testify, Jay was found guilty of murder on Sunday. Two witnesses come along and say, no, that's not true. You were with us, but Jay was found guilty of murder on Monday. So now to get that line straight, this is the bottom line. The trajectory is, we're in court on Tuesday, and we've said 2 days ago, Jay was found guilty of murder. Two witnesses come along and say, 2 days ago, you were with us at brunch, and that went the whole day. But yesterday, Monday, Jay was found guilty of murder. So when I was on the stand with John saying Jay was found guilty of murder, was he found guilty of murder?
Yes,
because it's Tuesday, and he was found guilty yesterday. But was he found guilty when I said he was?
No.
And it wasn't even before that. So I'm testifying to what I'm claiming is a fact that was unquestionably untrue. He was not found guilty by that point. The next day he was. So as I stand on the court and I'm pointing at Jay saying he was guilty of murder on Sunday, turns out that's not true, but he is guilty of murder and he was found guilty of murder yesterday. Okay, sounds like the same case. You found scheming, so what you said was true. And this is where Rava says no, they're not schemers and they don't get punished. Because we try to get Jay killed, but guess what? Jay's a dead man. God forbid. Meaning, once the verdict has been passed, if he was found guilty in court yesterday, he is called a bar katala. If they have passed the verdict, you are guilty of murder, you're now a dead person walking along, which is the crazy consequence, or the apparently crazy consequence, is at this point somebody could kill Jay, chas v'shalom, and not be guilty of murder. Because he is, legally speaking, dead. Once the court has passed a verdict, you're dead. You're dead. You can kill him. Again, not recommended. And there's kind of misa b'dei shamayim. But in the court of law, we can't hold you guilty of murder because we've said this person is dead, basically. That's how powerful the verdict is. So this is making the point. When court establishes a truth, it doesn't have to be factually true. Jay's breathing, his heart's beating. But legally speaking, he's dead. That's the truth. It's not about facts, it's not about history, it's about adjudicating the law under our purview. And that's as far as we can go. So, first line, we've said, two come along and say, on Sunday the verdict was passed. First word in the line, it was Va'u. You were with us on Sunday. But they were found guilty on Friday. Even on Monday we can say the verdict was passed, they were guilty. They do not killed. Why? At the time they testified, me and John testifying on Tuesday about Jay being a murderer, being guilty of murder, when we testified, the person was dead. Barakatala. They were a dead person at that time. So we weren't trying to get anybody killed. Which again is astonishing. We were trying to get Jay killed a little earlier than he would have been executed. And in American law, people sit on death row for 20 years. So we were trying to kill somebody who had 20 years of life left. And the Gemara is saying, you're undead. Is a reason it's called death row. You're dead. That's death. You're just breathing right now. But legally speaking, you are dead. Which means if I sneak into death row, and I in American law, I'm pretty sure you can't kill people on death row either. Right. Is that correct?
Yes.
It's come up?
No.
Right. But in halachic law, it seems to be if you were to sneak into death row and kill someone, legally speaking, we can't do anything. Which, of course, means it's an incredibly vulnerable place to be. And maybe we've got an obligation to make sure it's secure and whatever the case is. The Gemara doesn't get into that. But we weren't trying to kill someone. We were trying to, you know, mess up a corpse, legally speaking, which is not appropriate, but still not something to get executed for. And the next five lines we're just going to charge to because it's in a repetition of what he just said. But he says, and it's not only true in capital crimes, it's also true in civil crimes. If you testify that somebody was found to owe money, if it turns out they did, were found to owe money the next day, the same thing happens. So let's blast through. It's also true in terms of penalty, financial. They come along and say on Sunday they stole an ox and therefore they owe money. Manu even say, you were with us on Sunday. You couldn't know that. But it was on Monday that they stole Meshamim velo owed. You have to, velo, and even if they testify, Ella Afilu Oma Be'er Shabbos Ganav V'Tavach U'Machar Meshalmim, even if they say they stole it on Friday, meaning what you said historically was true, you still owe Debe Idna Kamasari Gavrilav Batashleminu, because at the time you testified, no verdict had been passed. They were walking around with money. Ba'ushnaim V'Amru, two come along and say, B'chab Shabbat Ganav V'Tavach U'Machar V'Nigma Dino, you say the verdict was passed on Sunday, they owe money. Ba'ushnaim V'Amru B'chab Shabbat Emanu, you were with us on Sunday, Eller of Shabbat Ganav V'Tavach U'Machar, but it did happen on Friday that they stole the Nigma Dino and the verdict was passed. But they said the verdict was passed on Monday. You don't pay David Idnach HaMasadi because when you testified, he owed money, full stop. So again, is that like not a crime to lie about something that is legally true? You still lied under oath, but there's no punishment for Edut Sheker. It's a Lav Shein B'Maaseh. And this is again why Edom Zomim is such an innovation. You've done nothing different. I lied under oath. But if we've said you were with us and you were testifying about something that was not legally true, you're going to get punished. It just raises the stakes. Because ordinarily there's no punishment for false testimony. So you could even say, you know, it's astonishing, lying under oath in Jewish law, there's no punishment. Here there's perjury. In Jewish law, there's no crime perjury. You can sit there and lie and lie and lie and lie and lie, and everyone can come along and contradict you and say, it's not true, it's not true, it's not true. And you carry on with your day. You know, God's not happy, but it's a Lav Shein B'Maaseh. And Edom Zomim is kind of the one exceptional case that's injected to raise the stakes in all of this. That if someone comes along and says, you were with us, everything could fall out on you. Even though perjury as a rule is not applied, there is this exceptional case that can always crop up. Someone can always come along and say, you were with us, and you get in trouble. Okay. Rabbi Yehuda Omer started here over the page. And here we'll have a little bit of a story in the middle to kind of move us along at a pace. Oh, I'm just seeing the time. We'll probably stop at the Mishnah then. Rabbi Yehuda said, if you've got a case where two people come along and testify, A killed B. Two witnesses come along and say, you were with us, it's impossible, regular case. Two other witnesses, no, A killed B on Sunday, you were with us. And then another case, A killed B, you were with us. And it's just piling on, everybody's with us. How could that possibly be? He started, the Gemara says, hold on a minute. If it is a scheme, Rabbi Yehuda, afilu kat rishon enamilo, we shouldn't kill the first set either. And you've said, you killed the first set. Amar Rabbi says, shikadmu vahargu. No, it's talking about a case when we happen to have already killed the first set. We killed the first set as Zomimim. Then two come along 2 weeks later and say, we saw A kill B on Sunday. And the same disqualifying set come and say, no, you were also with us. And they say, hold on a minute. We just killed two guys last week because you said that they were with you. Yeah. Either whoops or to be consistent, we've got to kill these guys too. Do we trust you or we don't? And Rubida says, at some point, we start to suspect there's a plan here. But you only kill the first set. How can you kill the first set? So Rabbi Abba was saying, it's a case when you already killed them by mistake, or whatever the case is. Elamar, my dahava hava. The Gemara says, That's not like a legal principle. That's an unfortunate accident. What happened, happened. But that's not like, oh, you only killed the first set. No, if you killed the first set, that's a mistake. But you don't kill anybody, Rabbi Yehuda. So that can't be what he means. Elamarava, Rava says, Hachi, come on, this is what he means. In the Eina Elakat Achat Nahareg, it means if there's only one pair, so it's one versus one, you kill only that one. Iikatfei, but if it's more than one pair, Eina Ragin, you don't kill him. And then the Gemara says, Ha bilvad kama, but in the Mishnah, so again, the end of the Mishnah, he says, Eino nehareget, last line of the Mishnah, Ela kat rishona bilvad, you only kill kat rishona. What does rishona mean? It means first. It doesn't mean the one. It means who killed the first set, which implies there's more than one. So how could that be? The Gemara finishes, Kasha. Yeah, I'm not sure what to make of this. And again, the commentaries will say, you've got to either amend the way the Mishnah is written, or you've got to assume he means only if there's one set, but it's formulated badly. But essentially, again, this is emphasizing the point. This is hard, very hard to adjudicate who's true. And here we get a case, and we say, oh, maybe this is the same thing. I itita, there was this woman, Dati Sade, who brought witnesses to Vishtaka, and they were found to be lying. Not schemers, but that's why this is not exactly the same, but they were found to be lying. They were contradicted in court. I.T. Sade, she brought another pair of witnesses, Vishtakor, and they were found to be lying. Avlat I.T. Sade, Achrini, she found a third set, Delay Shtakor, and nobody contradicted them. We couldn't disprove them, we cross-examined them, the third witnesses she brought. And whatever the case, she's saying, my ex-husband owes me $4 million. She got two witnesses say, we saw him, and then two other come along and say, you can't possibly have seen him then, because he was with us at that point. So that those witnesses aren't trusted. Second set, same thing. Third set say, we saw him, commit to owing $4 million. What do we say at this point? Amrei Shlakish, Reish Lakish says, Huchzakazu, she has now got a reputation for bringing false witnesses, so we don't trust this third set. So now the Gemara is intimating, maybe this is the same as Rabbi Yehuda. Do we have to have a concern when we're sitting on the bench as judges? Do we have to start thinking about what's the likelihood that they're lying? Or do we just look at the rules and say, if they haven't been caught out, they haven't been caught out? Are we trying to aim for truth, or are we trying to adjudicate based on law? Rabbi Lazar says, "Im hi huchzaka, kol Yisrael mi huchzaku." Meaning, you're right, she's not got a reputation for bringing false witnesses, but these two on the stand right now, we've never seen them before, and they're speaking under oath. You can't accuse them of having a reputation just because she's got a reputation. So now they're both trying to adjudicate what's the truth in this case. And the Gemara continues, Zimnin, occasionally, have a yantre kamed Rabbi Yochanan, people would sit around Rabbi Yochanan, ataki ay maisel kamayu, and this same conversation came up. So we had Reish Lakish and Rabbi Lazar disagree, and this is going to be important because he's going to get angry with his friend in a minute. Reish Lakish and Rabbi Lazar sitting there, they say, this woman's brought a third set, they aren't caught up, do we trust them or not? Reish Lakish says, we don't trust them, there's something afoot here. And Rabbi Lazar says, no, everybody's entitled to their innocence until proven guilty, and they're on the stand and they're testifying. The case came before Rabbi Yochanan, where are we? Zimnin have a yad for Rabbi Yochanan, Atagi Maisa Lakamayu. This event came before him, first brother in the lines Lakamayu. Am Reish Lakish, Reish Lakish said, Huchzakadzu. Oh no, the woman, so Reish Lakish is being consistent, saying she is suspicious. Rabbi Yochanan, and now Rabbi Yochanan says, not Rabbi Lazar, Rabbi Yochanan said, Im huchzakazu, kol Yisrael mi huchzaku, says exactly the same turn of phrase as Rabbi Lazar said. Suspicious that they sound exactly the same. And at that point, Hadar chazei le Rabbi Elezer bishut. At this point, Reish Lakish looks at his friend Rabbi Lazar and gives him a big stare and says, you didn't tell me you heard this from Rabbi Yochanan. Amle shmat mili demen barnach v'lai amat li mishmei. You heard some Rabbi Yochanan, you didn't tell me that. Full stop, he's angry. And now the Gemara is going to say, is this case, and we'll finish with this, is this case exactly the same as our Mishnah? In the Mishnah, you've got Rabbi Yehuda say, you've got 100 people being disqualified, there's something iffy there. I don't trust that they're all schemers. And now we've got a case where a woman has brought a third set after two cases of people found to be lying. Is it suspicious or not? Maybe it's the same. Do we entertain suspicions? Is what Lema Reish Lakish Damak Rabbi Yehuda Rabbi Yochanan Damak Rabbanan. Full stop, and then the Gemara can say, no, they're radically different. Amrei Reish Lakish, Reish Lakish says, Ana da Amrei lach afila l'rabbana, Reish Lakish, who said, I don't trust the woman, might say, no, that's only in this case. But I actually agree with the Rabbanan, who say, you can kill 100 schemers. There's nothing suspicious about disproving those schemers. Ad kan loka Amrei Rabbanan hatam. The rabbis say there that you kill all 100 sets, deleke kamahadar. Because it's not like they were all brought by some external, there's not one thing that has them all in common that make it suspicious. They could have all been at a party together. Who knows? But haka ika hak da kamado, here this is more suspicious because there's someone behind the scenes setting up the witnesses on the stand. Rabbi Yochanan Amar, Rabbi Yochanan might say, lachana da amri afila Rabbi Yehuda. Maybe I'm also with Rabbi Yehuda. Even though in this case I say you can't treat them as suspicious, maybe I'd agree Rabbi Yehuda's case is suspicious. Ad kan lakam Rabbi Yehuda hatam da aminan atu kule alma gabe hana avakamai. I could say, in the case of Rabbi Yehuda, how could they all be in a party together? It's suspicious. There are 100 people all in the same place at the same time. That sounds very odd. But here, each witnesses are independent groups. So it's not that suspicious. So maybe I would agree with the Mishnah. Full stop. We're going to stop here. Next time we'll pick up with the Mishnah. And I think the next stuff is a little shorter, but we may be pushing our way through that too. In the meantime, I want to thank you for your attention. We're going to work on getting closer to the truth, but for now, have a wonderful week.